This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Stacy Brown. She's a librarian and the 21st Century Learning Coordinator at the Davis Academy in Atlanta. She's also the author of the School Librarian's Technology Playbook, Innovative Strategies to Inspire Teachers and Learners. Circulating Ideas is brought to you with support from listeners just like you. Find out how you can help support the show by going to circulatingideas.com/support. Stacy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Or I should say welcome back, because you were on a little roundtable that we did at ALA a couple of years ago.
Yes, that's right.
I wanted to get started just how did you get into the library field, and then what kind of drew you to wanting to work in school libraries?
Great question. So I'm originally from Texas, and my mom is a librarian. She is an academic librarian. And she worked for 25 years in the basement of SMU as the head of the cataloging department. Mm-hmm. And one day her boss came to her and said, there's this amazing position open at Texas Women's University as dean of libraries. And so she went for it and she got it. And for the last decade of her career, she served in that capacity. And just at about that time, I had worked in alternative dispute resolution for American Arbitration Association. And while I was there, you know, I was always intrigued by her career. So I earned my master's in library science. And then I decided to shortly after kind of go for it and worked in a small academic library here in Atlanta. Started a family, realized that the academic position was tricky because I was actually running that department and it was 24/7. And so decided to make a shift into school libraries. And the Davis Academy had a position open. And at that time, I'm again kind of watching my mom's progression. And she ended up doing quite a bit for Texas Library Association, eventually serving as one of their presidents, and gave me the opportunity to present and share there when I still felt very much like a newbie in the role as school librarian. And it was such an awesome experience. And I just felt this, drive to want to do more of that. So ever since, I've just been, very kind of focused on uplifting my school through my department, but also contributing externally as well and meeting other passionate school librarians.
That's great. And it's all in the family. So maybe you'll pass it down to one of your children.
Very possibly.
So can you tell us a little bit about the Davis Academy and what your role there is? I guess we should say your role there normally, and then we'll kind of talk about what the role is maybe now in pandemic times.
Absolutely. So I believe this is my 14th year there. And when I first started, I was hired as their school media specialist for our lower school. I was hired alongside the middle school media specialist. She and I were both new together. Our campus is actually in two separate buildings. So they're a quarter mile apart. They are in walking distance of one another. Typically people drive, but you can walk. And, things really, when I started in that role, I just loved it. I loved teaching the kids about reading and literacy and all the creativity that can come with that. And I guess just my innate passion for really books and hearing other people's stories resonated. And I ended up really growing that program. I started connecting with the teachers more regularly and being kind of the risk taker in the school in the sense that we're always the ones pushing the envelope, which can sometimes be dicey. In the sense that, we are a faith-based organization. Our school serves, about 550 students of the Jewish faith. And, families send their kids there for the idea of educating the whole child. So instilling the school's values, instilling the Jewish education, and then, you know, of course, an academically rigorous environment is really important to our parent community. So there has been great opportunity being within an independent school to be flexible and creative within the confines of, you know, also having an awareness of when you go too far. So that has really been such an amazing experience to be on the, what I kind of consider as the edge of a cliff, pushing people with you to be brave and try new things. And I would say over the last few years, one of my department's goals, and I know we all talk about the concept of windows and mirrors, but one of my department's goals, we have really taken it upon ourselves to expose our students to diversity, really focus on inclusivity, especially given that we are, you know, kind of in a suburban area, one faith, for the most part. And therefore, we've been able to use like our maker education programs, our reading collection, and our basic general programming to expose our kids to different ways of thinking, different types of people, which has really kind of been scary and awesome at the same time. And I think very much appreciated. So I would say our school is very supportive of those efforts, but you know, there are times when you're treading uncharted waters where it can be scary,
right?
But we have an amazing administration and I feel very loyal and devoted to them. And, you know, sometimes I guess what I appreciate about working with the people that I do is that we have the ability to have very honest dialogue about what, you know, for example, I think may need to happen, and maybe they don't feel that, but then we can talk it out, which is just really an awesome place to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then obviously charting new waters even more so over the last month or so, 6 weeks, two months ago. How has your role changed? Like, I know teachers now have moved kind of their classes online, but how have you, as the person in charge of the libraries and media centers and learning coordination, how has your role changed in this time period?
Yeah, so I can be very bossy. And and along with that, I can really insert myself places that you could possibly argue aren't really necessarily within the confines of my role. And I would say that during this experience, that really came to light, because I was really first, I was concerned about our teachers and I wanted to make sure that they would have the support that they needed. In my role, I have the great fortune of working with the teachers, not only as a group leading professional development, but also one-on-one through talking about technology integration and innovating in their individual classrooms. And so, you know, I always say it goes back to the relationship and knowing very well what, you know, some of their comfort level, where that resides. I wanted to make sure that they felt like, not necessarily certainly like the expert, but they had someone to turn to during this process. So I started doing some research very frantically quickly and decided that Zoom would be a great video conferencing platform for us. And of course, having written the school librarian's technology playbook, I had done so much research unknowing that this was going to happen on different platforms that, you know, serve schools for video conferencing. And we had always done, you know, Skypes, we'd even done some FaceTimes, but we'd never had to disseminate video conferencing on such a large scale before.
Right.
And after feeling like Zoom was going to be the most accessible, that we could get it running quickly, very cost effective for our school, in that we could all access the free version with the exception of someone who is leading a huge assembly. And it just felt really good. So really getting them up and running on Zoom, making sure that they had the devices at home that they may need to support providing instruction. And then I established an infrastructure for our faculty where my principal and I designated about 8 people, one of which is myself, and we divided up all the faculty to fall under the umbrella of those 8 people. And we are essentially their faculty advisors. And we all kind of operate our group a little different depending on who is in our group. But in my group specifically, I have our kindergarten prep teachers, our kindergarten teachers, and then a huge chunk of our specialist teachers and some of our reading specialists and things like that. And then of course, our media assistant. And the way I approach it is every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I connect with them. I typically send something that is very personal, a personal story, just so that, you know, just to kind of remind them of the humanity of this process and that we're all in this together. You know, I talked about the day I pretty much had a nervous breakdown in my laundry room for a minute, or just, you know, quirky things that have happened to me. Mm-hmm. And then I share something helpful. I try very hard not to push out new technology tools all the time. I try to emphasize what they're already using, maybe taking it to the next level. And then I share something uplifting and maybe humorous, like specific podcasts or books that I'm reading or TV shows that have been great distractions or quotes, things of that nature. And I make a point of connecting with them at least 3 days a week so that when they have a problem, say on a Tuesday at 2 o'clock, they think of me as someone that they can quickly turn to and get support no matter what the issue. It could be, you know, a kid couldn't get into the Zoom and the mom is, you know, upset, or you know, their child in their own home is struggling and they just need someone to talk to, whatever that looks like. And so that support system has been huge to empower our teachers and make them feel like they are not swimming in a sea alone during these unprecedented times, and has also, you know, made a lot of us much closer as well. So there was that, there was the psychological component and getting everyone feeling supported on the teacher end and as though they were somewhat prepared in such a short amount of time to start doing real-time instruction via Zoom, and also trying to figure out schedules because some of our teachers have newborn babies, for example, and were limited in what they could offer their students during certain times of the day. So navigating all of those logistics with them. And then there was a huge focus on my part with my principal and head of school about communication. So, you know, how do we present the information to not only our teachers, but to our families? So a lot of people are, you know, visual learners, some respond better to audio. So how do we distribute critical information in a way that the majority can hear it and understand it and process it? And we certainly stumbled through that process in the beginning. How do you, what is your word choice? What are some of the perspectives that we haven't thought of that we need to take into consideration proactively? How do we get in front of some of the unforeseen problems? What questions should we be asking that we don't even know to ask yet? So kind of going through that whole communication realm with them and drafting that, you know, hours on end for this first couple of weeks was a huge piece. And then of course, sharing, I would say on a more micro level, just with individual teachers on specific tools in order to accomplish the different learning goals that they were trying to accomplish. And then we we're using a learning management system through Blackboard, which is a little bit clunky, but we're making it work. And we put together a distance learning tab, and we've curated, for example, ebook resources, all kinds of, you know, literacy resources. I put together digital netiquette for our students, reminding them of the do's and don'ts under this new format that we're communicating within. And, you know, basically, you know, just about anything you can think of, we kind of worked as a team to put that together fairly rapidly. And after we got through that, then I would say it was a lot of communicating with parents who, you know, felt so anxious. What is this going to look like for my child? And I, what if I'm still going into work and they don't have anyone at home to support them with the learning? What if I am just not equipped to do this or don't feel comfortable doing this as a parent? What if I have three children and two devices and they're all supposed to be on a Zoom at the same time? I mean, all of those kinds of questions and just really working through some of those logistical issues and I guess psychological issues, I would say kind of brought us into phase two. And then once we really got into it, we had the benefit, I can say benefit now, at the time it didn't feel like a benefit, but we had the benefit of having spring break, I would say about a week and a half to 2 weeks after rolling all of this out. And there were days where I literally did feel like I was limping into spring break. But we had a really long spring break just as the calendar fell this year due to the way Passover fell. So we had a week and a half and we were very worried. What is that going to mean for our students who don't have learning happening and a structure to their day? So it actually ended up being okay. I set up some virtual excursions on a daily basis that they could do as an option. And then each of our teachers were instructed to set up optional enrichment activities that were fun and creative that they could participate in if, you know, their parents needed them to be able to do that. And then, but it really gave the teachers a chance to iron out some of their kinks that they had learned along the way and just renew. And my principal extraordinaire revamped our Zoom schedule so that it was more accessible to more people. And it was easier to access all of their different times. And so that was a huge help. And I feel like now we're on Friday and we resumed school this past Monday. And so we're about 5 days in and it feels so much better, all things considered. And so now I find myself, we just got our virtual book fair up and running. It's live through Scholastic. I am helping teachers now differentiate their instructions. So I'm helping them find the ebook resources and how to use the technology to support small reading groups or even math groups for that matter. And then we are also starting to really hone in on some of the creative programming that we were doing before. We are hosting our virtual book club for fourth and fifth graders on May 7th. And then we're also on that same day doing a pajama day where we will have different leaders throughout the day hop onto Zooms and read to kids and they can, you know, participate or not. And then we are inviting grandparents to also do read alouds for the students. And then, of course, some maker challenges and things like that. So we're really trying to get somewhat back to some semblance of what we brought to the student experience before. And then we also were really well known for our birthday book parties where kids can come, they pick out a book, they get to plate the inside of the book and enjoy a treat in the library. And it's very special for them mm-hmm. and their parents are invited. So we just recreated that in a virtual format as well. So we're trying really hard to build the community while continuing the learning and just making sure people feel connected and that they're evolving in some way academically.
So the book birthdays that you're doing, when you open back up again, will those kids get to put their like book plate into the book physically?
Exactly. So they will get to put their book plate into the book. They will, which they've now already selected virtually. They were able to browse that through Follett. We put together a resource list and then they will get to have a treat and, you know, acknowledge that it was their birthday book. And then for the fifth graders who are now going to be in our middle school building, they will get to do the same just with the seventh and eighth graders. So it'll look a little different, but they will still have that opportunity.
That's fun. It's nice that we can kind of preserve some of the fun parts of it too, and not just, well, here's your schoolwork, this is all we can reproduce, but the fun parts as well.
Yes.
And is that what you're talking about, you know, helping the teachers get up to speed on all this stuff? Is that something that you normally do in just a normal part of your job as well? Like, are you involved in helping them with their professional development?
Yes. So normal, I do wear a lot of different hats. It started about maybe 6 years ago, where three times a year I would meet with each teacher one-on-one to talk specifically about their unique curriculum and the tools that could help them with their curriculum, making it relevant to the students in terms of how they delivered it. You know, really bringing some fun into the class, innovation into the class. And so over the years, I've been able to build strong relationships. And then I feel like we kind of plateaued in the sense that it was like, okay, let's not introduce any new tools. We have the technology. We've slowly grown that over the years. So now let's just focus on perfecting what we have going. And so now I tend to meet with the teachers more so as teams as opposed to individually. And we do planning together. So for example, at the beginning of the year, I meet with the third grade team and we look at their units and we talk about ways where they can work with me to bring it to a different level. So if they're learning about Native Americans, they will come and do work together to build a Native American village in Minecraft using the tools and the resources that were only available during the time period that they're learning about. And so it's really a partnership now between myself and the teacher. So it is something that I was doing before, and it looks certainly a little different now. But that is something that, you know, I've been comfortable doing with them for a while. And, you know, we have new teachers. So now I feel like I'm really working hard to build up those relationships and help them and show them I'm on their team and, you know, please, you know, let me help you. So yes, to answer your question.
Well, and that collaboration seems to be sort of at the heart of your book that you wrote, which we can kind of move into now. The book is The School Librarian's Technology Playbook, Innovative Strategies to Inspire Teachers and Learners. And that's, again, that seems like that's part of the job normally is this collaboration. What made you want to write a book about focusing on that collaborative effort?
So sometimes I feel like, you know, parents and teachers don't realize the just amazing resource that that school librarian can be. I do think, like, in every school, you have your groupies for your school librarians, but, you know, there's so much more even beyond those groupies that they can connect with and speak to. And I also feel, you know, again, kind of growing up in Texas and seeing the passion of the librarians there, that it is one of the most devoted professions that I've ever come across. I mean, they truly, you know, school librarians, we pour our heart and our soul into what we do. We believe in it so deeply. And so sometimes I think that they're the quiet leaders that can often get overlooked. And, you know, so much is really dependent upon personality, right? And I mentioned I can be bossy, but, you know, what about that person that isn't bossy by nature? And, you know, how are they being recognized as the incredible, valuable resource that they are within their school community? So I wanted to write a book that shared strategies for how school librarians can work with teachers and build those relationships to earn their trust, to allow those school librarians to influence what they are doing in the classroom, while also, of course, bringing it back to the library and showcasing what an awesome, thriving organism a school library, or any library for that matter, is, and why we should all be supporting it and, you know, thinking of it as the great resource that it is.
Yeah, and I think it's important that you start the book by kind of with a chapter talking about prepping, kind of almost like prepping your mind for this change, that prepping your mind to create a vision that you need to work around. Do you feel like that's something that school librarians really need to do kind of before they can get started with all this stuff, is kind of get into the right mindset?
Yeah, I think so many of them do recognize their value and that they have so much to offer. But I was somewhat surprised by a survey that School Library Journal just put out that reflected a pretty large percentage of school librarians, for example, did not even know that their schools were going to close until it happened. It was like they found out with everybody else. Whereas I feel like they should have been a part of that planning process and what that would look like once those school doors closed. And so I think that there's certainly, you know, there's different types of views about the value of school librarians that, you know, the community can have, but I think that they themselves need to know how valuable they are and have the confidence and the courage to sort of assert themselves, to be able to demonstrate that. And I guess I just wanted them to know that that can happen. You know, you can do that. You can be brave and you can put yourself out there and you can share your amazing knowledge with the world. And there are strategies to make that a little easier when it feels like it can be very challenging.
Yeah, sometimes you have to kind of take that power in yourself to empower yourself. And once you kind of do that, then you're exuding confidence then, and then people will pay more attention to you.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
In each chapter of the book, and we're not going to go through everything individually, because if you want to know everything individually, you should buy the book and read the book. You talk about a different tool that you discuss, and then you kind of discuss it in general, and then you get down to some practical applications for that. Why did you feel it was important that you wanted to include those practical applications for those?
Well, because sometimes we talk about tools in the very abstract, and I'll use the 3D printer as my example. So as I discuss in the book, there are some funny scenarios that I relay in the book that happened to me. And one of which was, I, as part of my role, I think it's important to go out to other schools and visit their libraries and see what they're doing and get inspired and, you know, find ideas. And just as I enjoy welcoming visitors to our school library. And, you know, I was touring all these libraries and everyone's got this 3D printer, right? And they're, you know, oftentimes sitting in the corner, not being used. Mm-hmm. And so, but it felt like, you know, we actually did have some parents who would come and tour our school and they would specifically ask, where is the 3D printer? Because it was something that you were starting to get used to seeing, and we didn't have one. And so I went to my boss, can we get a 3D printer? And he would say no, because he would say, you haven't demonstrated how it's going to enhance the learning and what it's going to bring to the curriculum and, you know, how it's going to benefit the students. So, I mean, this literally went on for 2 years. We have a joke, like he would look at his wrist and he'd be like, oh, 201, Stacy just asked for the 3D printer again, you know, and we would just go back and forth. So I started to get really smart. And I started to think about all these times that I've talked with teachers about their individual units and their lesson plans, and how would a 3D printer, if at all, because maybe it wouldn't, benefit those lessons. So I started to put that to paper, and I came back to him with a solid argument. We acquired the 3D printer, and his whole thing was, you know, 3D printers can be expensive, but it wasn't just about that. It was, or even about that at all. It was about, how is this going to be useful? And he would even challenge me. He would say, which schools have you been to where it hasn't been sitting in the corner collecting dust, you know? And he had a point. So I did a ton of 3D printer research, and we ended up acquiring the Zortrax M200. And I feel very strongly about that 3D printer, to the point where my editor of the book when she was going through the edits, she said to me, it sounds like you're being paid by them. You know, the way you talk about this 3D printer and gush about it, which I'm certainly not being paid by them. I get nothing from them, but I love that 3D printer because I'm not an engineer. And yet it is very, it feels like it is a very high tech, high quality machine. And yet I can still take that apart and put it back together. They have such amazing customer service and help desk. Even though they are in Eastern Europe, they will respond to you 24/7 despite the time change. And so once we acquired that, I started doing what I promised I would do in partnering with the teachers and integrating the 3D printer into what they were already learning. And, you know, of course, the kids were over the moon. They were so excited. You know, and it wasn't even about the novelty. It's just a really cool contraption. So, and that's something that really does, it has staying power. So I started building up even more trust, more relationships. The kids would be excited. They would ask about it. And so that one tool helped grow a whole, you know, movement beyond that. So I mentioned, for example, that I meet with the third grade team and we, you know, we, just as one example, but we plan now for the whole year, how are you going to work yourself into my lessons? What does that look like? And we put it on the calendar so that we have the whole year mapped out and we ensure that it's going to happen. And that's just kind of how some of the partnerships can be formed.
That's great. And you talk about, like I said, lots of tools like 3D printing. You talked about coding. You talked about QR code engineering. And of course, the most important one is podcasting. But how do you, are there any other ones that you want to talk about? Like in particular, you mentioned 3D printing there or anything else that was a particular favorite maybe of yours that you liked?
Well, so I really like them all. Okay, so two things. So the coding, I have to tell you, that was the chapter that I was scared to write the most because, you know, I'm not a computer programmer, although I do teach with quite a bit of coding, but I'm not high level, but I can facilitate anything. And yet that ended up being my longest chapter and one of the parts of the book that I am just so proud of because I realized through writing that chapter that coding is really a fabulous way to bring your community together. And we have done some awesome things with coding, one of which is, you know, the grandparent and parent hour of code where our student leaders facilitate an hour of code for their parents and their grandparents as the experts. And, you know, that has just been such an awesome experience, not only for those student leaders, but for those grandparents that get to come into the building and learn something new from these children is just so fabulous. It's amazing to watch that. And it gives the students a platform to share some of their coding projects that they've done over the past that they're proud of. So I do, I love coding as a way to build culture and community. And then you mentioned podcasts. I do love podcasts. I think that it certainly is a format that can allow different types of people to feel comfortable communicating. It speaks to a creative element. And our students, we had someone on my team, Jessica Osborne, she doesn't work with us anymore. She went into academic librarianship, but she started a few years ago a student created podcast where students could apply. And it was kind of a big deal because it was the first thing where students could actually not get accepted to something. But we felt like that was part of the learning process and evolving into an adult. And they had to go through a process of filling out an application, writing an essay. There was a blind panel that chose teams of students to create podcasts for celebrity visiting authors. And so they would research those authors and formulate interview questions. And then they had to learn how to mix the podcast together. So they had to learn those technical skills. They had to learn, you know, etiquette, how to make eye contact, the appropriate body language, and really just be little media experts and really provided a platform for them to share their voice. And so as that program has grown, this year in particular, I've done quite a few of those even through Skype. So I realized that the physical presence shouldn't be a limitation or dictate, you know, who they have access to, because the process looks very similar. So we've been able to really grow that author podcast series, and I'm really proud of that. And it's super special to the students who elect to participate in that.
Yeah, that's really great. And that's, I liked in that chapter too, that you had an option like to do, I forget what the wording is, like an analog podcast though, of how to do it like just on paper.
Yes, I really felt strongly in the book, because we all are at different kinds of schools, different kinds of communities. And I wanted to make sure that readers understand that all of these things can be accessible at so many different levels, even with the 3D printing. I mean, sometimes we elect not to 3D print a model, but the students can still build a 3D model, whether that's through online software like Tinkercad or even with pliable wiki sticks. There's all different forms of coming to that 3D modeling experience. So yes, I wanted readers to understand that these are things that can really happen in any school community. And I have found that sometimes the less resources that I have, the more creative I am forced to become. And it sometimes feels like the most powerful learning opportunity.
Yeah, I really think the best creativity comes out of limits, because you have to figure out a way around that limit. And so really makes you think.
It's true.
So, again, if people want to hear more about they want to see more about the details of this, please read the book, because it's a very good book with lots of good examples. But toward the end, you start to kind of bring all the ideas together, and it kind of almost all comes together in your chapter about student leadership, because that's kind of almost, you're kind of prepping kids for the future. I know you kind of do a program there at your school, but how do you encourage student leadership in the students? And then how do you feel like you can encourage other school librarians to take on that role as well?
So I think that whenever we are passionate about something and we start talking about it, that passion resonates with whoever you're speaking to. And I feel like, you know, as a school librarian, when you speak passionately about leadership and what it can look like, students become engaged, they become interested, they're piqued, they're curious. And I also believe, as I talk about in the book, that when students feel as though they are being trusted to take on some of the responsibilities that they've even watched adults do time and time again, it feels special to them. It makes them feel empowered. So by, I guess, packaging that in a way that does excite them and generate enthusiasm, and then, giving it a title or a label and making it almost like a club-like feel for those who are interested, it can really become something wonderful in your school. And so, for example, we started with our Network Sherpa program, which were really just students who were passionate about technology. It might have been a kid who's a gamer or a kid who likes to take apart computers and put them back together again, or work with robots, whatever interest that student had in technology. And they could apply to become a Network Sherpa, and they are given unique opportunities. They tour the school behind the scenes, how we use our technology at school. They go into the server room. They learn about the sound system. They get to go on some pretty awesome field trips to see things that really excite them specifically. And they present at conferences. They showcase their work at PTO meetings and board meetings. And it's really, really exciting for them. They have become a very valuable resource in our school. So teachers know who to go to when they have a question. So they might say, a fourth grade teacher or a seventh grade teacher might say, "Who's the Network Sherpa in the room?" You know, and so someone will raise their hand, and then the teacher will ask for their help. And so it's really an extension in some ways of help desk, but it also allows them to have a leadership role and learn more about a subject that interests them. And then this year we adopted that into our library. So we have library ambassadors, and they do grassroots marketing for our book fairs, book talks. They have adopted a shelf. So they're responsible for keeping those shelves neat and tidy and organized. They do book collection acquisition. They're given a little budget and they decide, you know, what they think would be great additions to their library. And we train them to think even beyond themselves. What would your friends like? Or what do you think, you know, a first grader would enjoy? And they might ask a first grader, what kind of book would you like to see in the library? And so it builds relationships. And then they go on field trips where they read to younger children as book buddies and student mentors. So, you know, empowering them at a young age to take on leadership roles so that when they do become adults and have the ability to make their own choices and decisions and impact the world in their own positive way, they have that confidence and courage to do so. I think building that at an early age is critical.
Yeah, and that's really what, I mean, that's one of the big roles of schools is to prepare kids for the future. So that's and that's a great tool to give to them. You wrap up the book kind of going back to something you mentioned earlier about the podcasting thing when they had to apply and sometimes they would fail. Your conclusion talks about that of when you try things, you're trying new things. That doesn't mean they're always going to succeed. So sometimes you need to learn from your mistakes. You need to revise and redo what you're doing. And I know a lot of people kind of get stuck in that. They kind of, when they fail, they want to just give up and wallow in that. And do you have any advice for people like that of how to take mistakes and be able to learn from them instead?
Yeah. So I love starting with the example of the fact that the building that we're standing in when we're at school, for example, or the house that we live in or the apartment that we live in, that didn't exist at one point. And there wasn't necessarily a blueprint for what that would look like. So an architect comes in and draws up plans for that vision. And that comes from their own imagination. And they understand that through that process, they're going to have to make changes and edits. Maybe they learn something about the potential client's needs, or maybe they realize, you know, there's something out of their control. Maybe they're in a floodplain, so they have to build the building differently. There's all different kinds of variables that impact that. But the point is that they start somewhere and they put it to paper. And then from there, they build upon that and they make edits and revisions, and they have to fail before they can reach a place where they feel like they've obtained success. And I think getting students comfortable with failure so that they can ultimately get to success is really important for resilience and grit, and teaching them not to give up and that this is just part of the process, which kind of goes back to something else I talk about at the end of the book, which is the value of reflection. So reflecting, where might I have quit or felt like I wanted to quit, but persevered. And because of that, this is where it led me. You know, thinking about those places in the process where if you had given up, it really would have been unfortunate for a variety of reasons. So yes, I think that, you know, talking to students about feeling like we all fail and failure is part of it. And that's why I like to share personal stories, because I've failed time and time again at many things, and making people understand that that's just part of being human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even on the positive side of that, I mean, you can also, when you're reflecting, you can think about what went right and why did that go right? And how can I replicate that part of it and keep that going too?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Stacy, thank you so much for coming on the show today to talk about your book and your work. If people wanted to get in touch with you to follow up on anything, how can they get in touch with you?
So they are welcome to reach me through social media or email. My social media platforms on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn is at 21st Stacy, 21STACY. And then my email is stacybrownreads@gmail.com. And people are welcome to, you know, share with me their thoughts. I would love to engage in a discussion with them. And then if they're interested in purchasing a copy of the book, they can go directly to ABC-CLIO's website, and they will ship out a book. And it's available in ebook format as well.
And I'll include the link to that in the show notes. So if you're listening to this, go look in your podcast app and click on that link. All right. Thank you so much, Stacey.
Thank you.
Hey, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Circulating Ideas is produced in the suburbs of Atlanta. Views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of my place of work or the place of work of guests. For past interviews, visit circulatingideas.com and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or a review. You can follow the show on Twitter at @CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Theme music is by Pamela Klicka, and the logo is by Shandy Fry. Thanks for listening, and keep circulating your ideas.